This is The Takeaway for Monday, April 3rd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, coming to you today from St. Louis Public Radio. We're on a hill overlooking the Mississippi River and the famous St. Louis Gateway Arch. In this collision of rivers, the city of St. Louis was born. The water highway north from the deep south, taking the poorest of the poor after the Civil War to the prosperity of what would become the industrial wealth of the Gilded Age. Wasn't shared equally, though. This is the city of second chances, remade lives, and yet it also represents a place where a few blocks separates the richest from the very poorest citizens. The state of Missouri is nearly right in the middle of the pack when it comes to income inequality in the U.S., ranking 22nd out of 50 states, according to a report issued last year by the Economic Policy Institute. On Friday, the Trump administration disclosed the financial statuses of its top officials, part of a prolonged government tug-of-war with the media over what ultimately may become the release of the Donald Trump tax returns, which will tell us some more about the Trump empire. But while the White House seems proud that its officials have more substantial financial holdings than members of the Obama administration, perhaps that's cynical, perhaps not, the disclosure once again calls into question whose interests are actually at the heart of this administration. Stephen Fusari is a professor of economics and sociology at Washington University, right here in St. Louis. He joins me now to discuss where income inequality might be going under President Trump. First of all, Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Secondly, is there a point where you are too rich to be able to see an undistorted economic reality when you're making economic policy?
Well, I think there is something to that. I think that in the policymakers are coming usually from very high profile jobs, elite universities and things like that. And maybe what the Trump phenomenon partially showed us was how the Washington elites are somewhat disconnected with people who have been struggling for 10 years, 20 years, even 30 years to reach the kind of lives that they expected to see when they were younger.
If you were to aggregate this Trump administration, who do they represent as a constituency, and how do they relate to the rest of the nation from a financial viewpoint?
Well, the Trump administration as a whole is extreme, as you just said, John, in the wealth of the people that have taken positions. Trump himself was proud of the fact, is proud of the fact, that he amassed a huge amount of wealth and views that as a badge of success. And he surrounded himself with many people who were coming from Wall Street or other very high income, high profile positions. So it is the case that the administration is very, very, very different in terms of its economic profile than the average American citizens, and certainly the people in the lower part of the income distribution, who are widely viewed to have given Trump the close victory that he got. So it's a very different group from the people as a whole. But that's maybe not so unusual, that our presidents typically are not drawn from the middle class as this goes forward. But in the Trump case, it's really pretty extreme.
And there were rich people in the Obama administration, Penny Pritzker of the Commerce Department, among others. But it occurs to me that since this party and this administration likes to evoke the Reagan era so much, the 1980s, I do recall that as an argument made that the success of one piece of the economy is going to transfer into success for another piece of the economy, the old trickle-down economics. And while I don't recall the income distribution of the administrations back then, it seems to me this is perhaps a subtle but really important shift. Back in the 80s, they talked about trickle-down economics as some sort of mechanism that they looked at from afar. Here, it seems that people like Trump and the people he's surrounded himself with are absolutely convinced that trickle-down works so well. In fact, that their success must be other people's success as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. You know, I was a young professor in the Reagan administration. I came to Washington University just a year after Reagan took office, right out of graduate school. And I remember those years, too, and the theory of trickle-down economics, I sometimes talk with my students about whether it's a trickle or a waterfall in some respects, becomes the big question for those kinds of policies. You know, overall, I think the evidence is not very supportive of the idea that when you have big tax cuts for the at the highest level, highest levels of the income distribution, that this has a big effect on middle class and certainly on the people at the bottom of the income distribution. We had lots of big tax cuts in the 1980s and in the early 2000s with the Bush tax cuts especially. And we saw income inequality continue to grow, the rich doing better than everyone else during this period of time. So in some sense, there's not a lot of support for that trickle-down theory. And I agree that there's a confidence in the Trump administration that the kinds of tax plans they're putting out there will help everyone. He emphasizes the tax cut for the middle class. His very wealthy Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, also talks about big tax cuts for the middle class. But whenever you see a proposal, the benefits go very disproportionately to those at the very top of the income distribution. So I'm a skeptic of the argument, and I think there's a faith that it's there. I think the people that voted for Trump appreciated the way he identified with their situation, that he connected with working people, with people whose economic outcomes were disappointing. But I'm skeptical that the policies are actually going to do what the people who voted for him hope for.
We're talking with Stephen Fazari, professor of economics and sociology at Washington University, right here in St. Louis. Stephen, when we talk about economic development, I've been, you know, here for about 24 hours in St. Louis and looking at the economy in Missouri. There does seem to be a new economy emerging here in Missouri. I don't know how you would characterize that. There's certainly not the let's go back to the old, steel mills and old kind of factory economy sense on the street. But how does the economic success of the Trump administration distort or help their view of economic development, the kind of industries to support versus the ones to walk away from?
I think it's a really important question. The Trump campaign really emphasized manufacturing. There was the early trumpeting, to use a bit of a pun there, of the few hundred jobs that supposedly were saved at Carrier, the manufacturing jobs. There's talk about bringing back coal jobs. And if you look at the economic trends over time, you see that these things are very unlikely to work, that manufacturing, mining, these kinds of things have seen long-term declines in the share of employment that they represent. And so when people want that to come back, I think Trump gave us the sense that that was possible, but I don't think it's true. I agree that here in St. Louis, you see this. You see biotech jobs. You see a new sector, which is more in the computing high-tech area and other kinds of things like that. And, of course, you see a big increase in service sector jobs, which historically have been paying less. So it seems like we have this bifurcated economy. The tech leading jobs are doing very well. More jobs being created there, higher pay. And then a lot of the job creation is in a relatively low paying service sector. And it's just not clear what policies of the Trump administration will change those trends, despite the rhetoric.
Well, what is clear is that it will take a nuanced policy to support both ends of that service sector and that high tech sector. It's not something you're going to do with just one feel-good executive order. Back to the tax cut before we go. When extremely rich people decide to make tax policy, is it the case that they tend to focus mostly on other rich people because they're paying a bigger number in terms of taxes?
I can't really tell you what the policy or what motivates this idea that cutting taxes for the rich is going to be so beneficial. I suppose it seems sensible that people who are very rich and see the undoubtedly high amounts of tax they pay, a large percentage of their income goes to tax. There's no doubt about that. And they feel like, well, this is the government's taking too much and this in some sense is unfair. But that's a big stretch from that perspective to the idea that somehow these tax cuts are going to unleash great amounts of productivity and entrepreneurship and the kinds of things that would create jobs more broadly across the income distribution. And like as I said earlier, I don't think the evidence really supports that perspective. You know, we've had a technology boom in the late Clinton years, probably the best period of time since the 1960s in the U.S. economy, when tax rates actually have been risen somewhat. So there really isn't a lot of evidence to support this idea that tax cuts for the rich are in fact going to trickle down in any meaningful way. It's a policy that I don't think will help those who put Donald Trump in office.
Stephen Fazzari is a professor of economics and sociology at Washington University. Thanks so much.
Glad to be with you, John.
We came here to St. Louis, Missouri on a beautiful but windy spring day, and I wondered if I brought my own guitar, I might find some blues players to sit in with. Great. I got a broken string I discovered at the airport. Anyway, is this the kind of community that likes to just break into song? It's maybe been doing some healing after the death of Michael Brown nearly 3 years ago.
I mean, the cops, they're like trying to be more involved with citizens to show that they're just like us.
Well, in a parking lot of a music store, young Richie is buying some strings just like me. At least we know that about St. Louis. You can always get guitar strings on a Sunday afternoon. But these young African Americans and two white kids from the sprawly suburbs wanted us to know that things seem cautiously better now.
Not too long ago, I went to this camp, and like they came out, and they got involved with what we were doing. They had joined the kids, made the kids laugh, and the camp was mostly populated with African American kids. So you can see how they would be kind of scared at first, but when you realize it and get down, you see that the cops are like regular people, like people you see walking down the street.
Yeah, I think the police forces in the central or the St. Louis metropolitan area are trying, they're slowly but surely trying to make themselves known that they're an average human just like we are. Once they come out of the office, they take the uniform off, they're an average Joe, and they want the community to know that, and they're slowly but surely getting.
I can't speak for everyone in St. Louis, but for me, like personally, I feel like we're just like, they really, like, we're still United States of America, like, even whatever president, whatever we have as governor, we're still one country.
Brown, where you live, is it a little more...
It's definitely conservative. We moved down there after living in North St. Louis, now we're in South Cape. And, like I was saying, it's Rush Limbaugh's hometown, and there's a lot of, like, my boss runs a bar for college kids, but she's definitely pro not helping them, I guess. I don't know, but...
And you found yourself in the middle of the Michael Brown thing.
Yeah, I worked with his aunt, and I worked with a girl that eventually became a cop. And I think what's important to look at is a dialogue has started. We get to have conversations like this. People are interested in making friends and moving forward.
Later this hour, exploring and actually playing how the blues took the sting out of change in St. Louis a long time ago, and maybe still doing it today. And we've been hearing your blues over the weekend. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I'm calling from Louisiana.
From Wanta, Belvedere, California.
I've never sang the blues before, but I sure did feel it when I turn on the news.
My blues are snapped. And I hope to death that you struggle to walk on your own two feet from here.
We are dealing with the future blues.
Sorry, that's just how it is. I'm a mom and I can't afford the price of your price.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at floridathefutureishere.com.
I just can't get enough of those Takeaway listener blues. Please keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's fantastic. And I even like those young kids in that windy parking lot there that we talked to yesterday. But seriously, when 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed by a white officer in Ferguson outside of St. Louis, his death began a national inquiry into police brutality that has become an open debate and a diverse constitutional conversation about the entire U.S. criminal justice system. Nearly 3 years ago, a group of community members came together to form the Ferguson Commission to examine what happened, make recommendations for the future. That report, called Forward Through Ferguson, came out in the fall of 2015. Lots of reports like this get written and read, and what happens next? Well, The report compiled a list of calls to action that included updating the police department's use of force training and creating a civilian review board. Amy Hunter spent a lot of time listening to and contributing to the commission. She's manager of diversity and inclusion for St. Louis's Children's Hospital, longtime activist in Ferguson. Amy, welcome back to The Takeaway. It's great to see you.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
How do you feel at this particular moment? It's almost like a different world politically if we look at the nation, but I just feel a lot of embrace of local initiatives here in St. Louis, even in my brief time.
There certainly has been a change in the conversation, so people at least having the conversation they weren't having prior to the tragic death of Michael Brown. And so that has been positive. We've seen corporate America step up to the plate. Ameren's created an online resource with videos and curriculum free for anyone's use. Certainly where I work at St. Louis Children's Hospital, we've seen our leadership embrace the Ferguson Report and implement many of the strategies in the work that we are doing at the hospital.
When we were on the air, there was a live town hall meeting that we had, and I remember one woman very, very vividly saying, "I'm going to think about how I can talk about white privilege." It was kind of a, you know, halting, stuttery sort of remark, but emotionally, she had come to a new place. Are people figuring out how to talk about white privilege in a place where at that town meeting people felt like, well, you can't see anything of what's going on. We see everything of what's going on.
Yeah, I certainly think we've got some great initiatives. So Mary Ferguson is now leading the initiatives at the YWCA with Witnessing Whiteness. Over 1,000 people here in St. Louis have gone through that. White people have gone through that. And they're teachers and doctors and police officers and federal law enforcement officers. Certainly that has made an impact. That program has launched in 17 other cities across the United States. So we've seen a ripple effect of the activism that occurred here in St. Louis.
Can I take you back in time and play for you something that you said when you were with us a few years ago?
Sure.
All right.
I think what we thought as people of color is that racism was really obvious, and what came out of Ferguson was that it wasn't really obvious. And so I think we all make a commitment to change. I think that, you know, what will kill our community is the stagnation of saying we're going to stay the same or nothing's wrong or everything's fine. And so I think we should make a commitment to acknowledge there is a problem first. That's our first step, like in AA. And then make a commitment to saying that we're all going to be better. And what that better looks like is that we're going to work towards each other. And maybe that means that we're going to have to forgive ourselves for being a hostile, racist community, right? And then commit to each other again to say, we're going to fall in love with each other, treat each other as if we're family, and work towards equity.
How would you say the community's done since you made those tough remarks?
I've actually changed those tough remarks to probably even tougher remarks and said that better probably isn't good enough. We need to strive for awesome. And what does that look like in every institution that we have? So are our schools awesome? Is our healthcare system awesome? Have we ended the economic divide? And when we're talking about health disparities, Jason Purnell's work certainly, and for the sake of all, has given us another lens. That was part of the Ferguson Report to say, hey, your zip code matters for lots of things in your life. So I really don't want St. Louisans to rest on better. I think we're good at when it gets a little bit better resting right there. I want us to strive for awesome. I want us to be the city that Chicago and San Francisco people want to come live in because we're just that amazing. So I think I've probably elevated the bar since then.
Well, that's ambitious. How would you say the politics is in Missouri right now? You've got a Senate race that's important. You've got a mayoral race, I believe.
Yeah, actually, the Ferguson mayoral race is this week. So that will be a run that hopefully people will come out and vote for. We certainly just had one for the St. Louis City. So we are seeing more people of color actually running for political office, which also gives us hope. The one piece of legislation that actually did pass was putting a lid on police departments profiting off of the backs of poor and brown people. So that's also very hopeful so that their motivation for stopping and ticketing people is no longer an increase in pay for themselves. So that's hopeful, too.
With the Trump election, what you saw in part, aside from his own particular success, was a wave of anger move through America following other waves of anger that may have, you know, begun with what happened in Ferguson. How do you see what's happened? And when we talk about the criminal justice system, the whole Trump thing doesn't really enter into it, it seems to me, that these are local conversations, and I'm surprised by that.
Well, yes and no. I mean, we certainly see an uptick Certainly, even where I work, we see an uptick of people being not just brave, but brazen with their anger. Mm. And so that's disappointing. I don't think that people of color are surprised. I do think it is surprising to white people how many other white people are speaking out in ways, in words that they never thought they would ever hear. That has been heartbreaking, disappointing. But it's also pushed people together in a place. 45 has definitely pushed people in a place together to work collaboratively across racial lines, religious lines, in a way that we weren't prior to Ferguson. So there is a benefit to some collaboration around making sure that the policies and procedures that go forward are not just had.
What's the next step? We just got a few seconds.
Next step is that people really get involved with stuff. I know people are really tired. It has been almost 3 years since Michael Brown. I hope they've gotten some rest because we have a long way to go. This is not the time for people's voices to be silent. This is the time for people to speak up and out and love one another hard.
And you sing the blues, right?
Not that well.
Well, it's great to talk to you again. Amy Hunter, Manager of Diversity and Inclusion for St. Louis Children's Hospital. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great to see you again.
Thank you.
The streets of Caracas, Venezuela last week after the Venezuela Supreme Court seized power from the National Assembly, effectively dissolving the elected legislature. After intense scrutiny both on the domestic and international fronts over the weekend, the court reversed course, rolling back parts of this controversial decision. Who's ruling? It's anyone's guess. It was seen as setting the stage for one-man rule under President Nicolas Maduro. Meanwhile, Venezuelans continue to face a growing humanitarian crisis throughout their country, with food shortages a daily reality. Carolina Acosta Alzuro is a media studies professor at the University of Georgia who's from Venezuela and whose family still lives in the country.
From a personal perspective, I'm extremely worried because my whole family is there and my friends. I grew up there. I was born there. It's my country. I love it dearly. From an academic perspective, I'm also very worried. The government of Nicolas Maduro has become increasingly authoritarian. Last week's events were very worrisome to me for several reasons. I think it's a government that's determined not to hold elections ever again. And that has to worry anyone. It's completely anti-democratic.
Are elections doable?
Of course they are. They have just been like postponed by the government because they know they will lose the election. So they're not going to hold elections. And that's the major point here for a government that needs to be democratic, in which they have been holding elections so far because they knew they could win them. But once they realized they could not win them anymore, they are not holding them.
What do you think is going on between the judiciary and the executive? Is there any precedent for the Supreme Court seizing power from the National Assembly? Is this a constitutional process?
This is not constitutional. Before the two rulings last week, there had been 54 rulings from the Supreme Court, the Supreme Tribunal, against the National Assembly, which is the elected legislative body. So this is not new. The problem is that last week, there were two rulings, and one of them literally stripped away the legislative body of its functions and gave powers to Nicolas Maduro. And they had to know that they were going to risk, you know, international pressure against this ruling. They knew it would have a backlash. So why take that calculated risk? And I think the calculated risk is taken for economic reasons.
Is it possible to compare President Maduro with the late President Chavez, who, while beloved of the people, was also seen to be something of a one-party ruler, a dictator, a person who didn't necessarily embrace elections?
Well, first of all, Nicolás Maduro doesn't have at all the charisma that Hugo Chavez had. He doesn't have also the sort of the control over his own people, the chavismo that Hugo Chavez had. So Nicolás Maduro he ran on the coattails of late President Chavez and won by a little bit. And then he has tried to keep going on those coattails. But that, of course, wears thin when people are beginning to be hungry and all that. Also, oil prices went down. So there's a lot of things that were happening at the same time. He does not have the approval ratings that Chavez had ever. And Chavez was a sort of a one-party man. He actually planted the seeds of this storm that we now are leaving. But these are two very different characters and two very different characters in the way they relate to the Venezuelan people.
How does the Maduro government relate to the military in Venezuela?
That's a very important question, because the military, he has included the military in the government. So you see many more posts, governmental posts, that are in military hands than you used to see in the Chavez government or ever before. And so that is important, because usually when you have a situation like we have right now in Venezuela, in which you have, you know, the social and economic situation is stark. You have scarcity, you have hunger, you have crime rates that are soaring, human rights are a disaster, media control by several ways. Usually you think of the military, well, are the military going to like abide this, you know, or are they going to do something? But the military, in a sense, are like a black box. We don't really know what's happening inside. What we know is that many of them are in the government. And there have been, you know, investigative reports that are very important, like Associated Press did one, in where you can see that the military are actually part of the sort of mafias that control the corruption around food imports, etc.
What does your family tell you about what's the next stage? I mean, are they experiencing the scarcity and the hunger? And is there a point at which, you know, they're going to pack up and leave?
All this has actually shown even more the differences between the haves and the have-nots. So the haves have the opportunity to buy things in the black market, at black market prices, and my family would belong to that part. The have-nots are in line endlessly to buy, you know, staples that they may or may not find. They go online to buy whatever they can find. My family buys most of their things on the black market. Still, for instance, I am going soon there, and they already sent me a list of things that I should bring with me to bring to my mom, where I stay. My mom is elderly. So I'm bringing, I can tell you the list. It includes rice, sugar, coffee, flour, or, you know, oil for cooking oil, which I don't know how I'm going to take that, soap, dishwashing soap, toothpaste, and of course, medicines that are here are so basic, like aspirin or acetaminophen or ibuprofen. You can find them there. So that's the situation. It's my mother. I have four siblings. They all live there. And my mother is actually a U.S. citizen. So for her, it would be easy to come here. But she has most of her children there. And she's elderly. She doesn't want to leave.
Carolina Acosta Alzuro is a media studies professor at the University of Georgia, worried about her family in Venezuela as we are, watching a nation slowly fail or slowly turn a corner, unknown at this point. Carolina, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Clicking Facts Away. A climate change researcher, Victoria Herman, managing director of the Arctic Institute, a Gates Scholar at Cambridge University, and a National Geographic explorer, has discovered that some of the global warming data provided on the federal website that she posted it on has been erased, delinked. It's been archived for the public, but what Herman and her colleagues are most alarmed by is the message being sent. While global warming is being pushed aside by the Trump White House, the coastal communities that Herman and her colleagues are hoping to protect, they're bracing themselves for the next major natural disaster to hit. According to Herman, scientists and citizens will face more challenges getting the real facts with global warming research under attack by the federal government.
In the hours after the inauguration, the content manager of our website sent me a frantic email saying that we had a number of broken links on the website. So I had to go back and see what those were. They were some of the most important policies that the United States has of the Arctic, and they were all housed on the Obama administration's website. So all of those went defunct in January. So I had to go back and find where those were. Most of those were archived, and you inevitably have some broken links when you go from one administration to the other. But what's more challenging is the ones that are continuing to come 2 months later in places like the EIA or DOE.
And that's really the new sort of lingua franca of certain policy approaches to something like climate change. It's not burning books. It's breaking links.
Exactly. It's breaking links. It's making them more difficult to access, both from the public in education sites, but also for researchers who now have to go through paywalls and peer-reviewed journals to try to find comparable data from what was publicly available on government sites.
You know, the implications of climate change are pretty obvious and unmistakable up there in the Arctic, and there are some arguments that climate change is a good thing up north.
Yeah, so there are definitely opportunities, but also a lot of challenges in Arctic that's warming twice as fast as the rest of the world. Where I work as a National Geographic Explorer is along the coastlines of the United States, and some of the most dramatic effects I've seen over the past year and a half have been on the Alaskan coast in places like Shishmaref or Shaktulik, villages that will need to relocate in full further inland because of the effects of climate change.
What would have been done in the past? Say there was a volcano or some geographic event or geological event, the government would study the implications of, say, Mount St. Helens erupting and would prepare plans, right?
Right. So we do have a lot of plans in place through FEMA and other federal agencies for quick onset disasters. So those are things like Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Katrina that come in, they displace people, and then you have to react quickly. What we actually don't have a very strong history of is those slow onset disasters. So how do you prepare for a community that it will not be livable in the next 10 years, but it's not because of a hurricane, it's because their shoreline continues to erode at 50 feet a year until the houses are falling into the ocean.
Do you know communities where you could make a phone call right now and tell people in 10 years it's over, folks?
Oh, they already know. Earlier this year, I was in Île-de-Jean-Charles in Louisiana, which is the first community that has received federal funding to relocate in full because of the effects of climate change. So that community knows, as does the ones I previously mentioned in Alaska, that their homes won't be around in another 10 years.
What's your worst case scenario based on either links that are broken and the things that aren't going to get discussed in time?
I think the worst case scenario is just a lack of action from the Trump administration for the communities most at risk today. So a lack of funding and technical assistance for places that know the next storm next fall might be their last in the community that they're currently in. And when they get emergency evacuated to another place, whether that be a close by city or a larger village in their rural area, that there will be no assistance and no support for them in that wider area, and they'll face a lot of socioeconomic issues there.
Victoria Herman is managing director of the Arctic Institute, a Gates Scholar at Cambridge University, and a National Geographic Explorer. Victoria, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Five to get off a shot. William on the drive. Pull up, pull up. Got it! She got it! She got it! She got it! One of the great upsets in history. Mississippi State in overtime at the buzzer.
First, it was the end of the 111-game streak of the University of Connecticut women's basketball team. 5'5" guard Morgan Williams buzzer beater and Mississippi State upset UConn during Friday's Final Four matchup. Audio courtesy of ESPN. But that was just Act 1. Would Mississippi State have anything left for the final game against South Carolina? Nope. The SC Gamecocks won their first NCAA Women's Basketball Championship by the score of 67-55.
A spectacular performance, and South Carolina has won the national championship.
Well, the men are going to have quite an act to follow with their final tonight. North Carolina returns to the finals, this time facing off against Gonzaga, the first-timers from the West. Michelle Vopel, a columnist for ESPNW and ESPN.com, says, All you can say about this weekend was awesome.
I think going in, most of us honestly expected this to be UConn's fifth consecutive national championship. But their streak was broken, and it was broken in really one of the most dramatic games I've ever seen at the women's Final Four, with a last-second shot from Mississippi State. And then Mississippi State didn't end up winning the championship. And instead, it's South Carolina winning their program's first championship and also the first for Dawn Staley, who's really a legendary figure in women's basketball.
And such an emotional figure as well. I mean, she had a lot on the line this season that, you know, many of us who tuned in late to the tournament just discovered in the way she was talking after the game.
I really can't see myself doing anything other than what I'm doing and impacting the lives of young people, and also being able to, you know, check this box off in my career.
With Dawn Staley, she's somebody that people who followed women's basketball have watched her ever since she was a player. She's really one of the greatest players in women's basketball history. Somebody who went to three Final Fours as a player at Virginia, didn't win a championship, then became a professional, a three-time Olympian, is going to be the U.S. Women's Olympic basketball coach now. She just got that title. So she really had everything in her career except a national championship at the college level. Lost one of her main players, a senior center, Elena Coates, to an injury, and had to play in the tournament without her, and then was still able to win the championship.
Can we go back to that buzzer beater at the Mississippi State upset of University of Connecticut? I mean, that just came out of the blue. Can you talk us through it once more?
Yeah, you know, I think the thing about Mississippi State is they were a team that had knocked off another number one seed in Baylor in the regional final, and they were really confident coming into this game that they would be able to win it. And then it was their point guard, Morgan William, who had a wonderful game in the regional final with 41 points. She's the one that got the buzzer beater, and it literally was a buzzer beater. The ball went through the net, and the horn sounded. The arena just went crazy. So it was really an amazing finish.
Well, the end of the men's tournament is going to have a very high bar to get over to meet the excitement of what happened in the women's tournament. Gonzaga knew from the West in this final, but North Carolina has been here before. This is kind of the matchup we expected. How do you feel about this final for the men?
For the men, you know, actually, I think the newcomers, Gonzaga, I think they're going to win. I think they've been the most complete team all season, even though, you know, obviously North Carolina is the brand name and basically about as storied a program as you can get. I actually think Gonzaga has all the answers, and I think they're going to win, in which case we're going to have two new champions, Gonzaga on the men's side, and South Carolina never won before, and now they have a championship.
Michelle Vopel, columnist for ESPNW and ESPN.com. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You really get the feeling down here in St. Louis, Missouri, that this is a place that's used to change during the many great migrations from east to west and south to north. The city gained friends, saw a nation's tensions growing. The blues accompanied this mixing of people and culture all along. As African Americans moved from the Deep South Delta region to points north, Chicago, they passed through this city carrying with them the musical traditions of jazz and the blues.
I grew up with the blues. The blues is part of me and my family.
UV Hayes carried it with her, and so did her family.
I've been listening to the blues since, wow, I can't even remember. I would think about 10 is when I really became interested and just really started to pay attention. And then maybe 2 or 3 years later, I entered a talent show in my local high school, and guess what? I won. So from then on, you know, then the church people said, listen, if you can sing the blues in the school, that means you need to be in the choir. So I went from there to the choir, and the rest is history, and I've just been doing that since. I had to go out and do what I had to do.
I had to sing this thing.
Yes, I did.
We spoke with UV Hayes at the National Blues Museum yesterday, celebrating its one-year anniversary. Executive Director Dion Brown says the museum is a work in progress and a joy. It showcases the history that UV and people like her carries around in her heart, along with the music industry that is all now and tech and DIY these days.
You know, to be relevant in the museums today, so you get the story, you get the tale about the blues, but we're an interactive museum also. So you have an interactive component where you can write your own blues riff, then you put a harmonica track, a guitar track, and a piano track, and then in the Jack White Mix It Up room, you develop it, you lay the tracks, and then you email it to yourself. So that right there keeps us relevant to the younger generation to introduce them to the blues. And now we have live music, so then we hook you because now you've gotten the story of the blues and how it impacts different music genres. And then on your way out, you catch a live blues performance that has been just tremendously successful for us. And then the blues musicians themselves, when they're on stage, most of them tell a story about the blues and how it impacted their music.
There was a live performance going on yesterday afternoon. Skeet Rogers and the Inner City Blues Band was playing. I had my guitar with me, and I was nervously wondering if they would let me play along. But my butterflies went away when director Dion took me to see part of the museum that showed off some breathtaking history of St. Louis and this entire region.
We're walking into the gallery now. This is our great migration wall here, and it's a wall of suitcases. But it tells the story of the suitcases they would have during those days, and it's got pictures of different people, and that one is a good shot of a juke joint right there. And that's where people would go on Saturdays after working in the plantations and have their parties. And like I say, this wall is emotional to me, just because living in Mississippi, you see these cotton fields, you see the different plantations, and some of the people that I met while I lived in Mississippi, they still had luggage like this. And to hear the stories behind them, I can just imagine how, you know, getting on the steamboat, riding up the Mississippi, trying to get out of the South, or by any means necessary, this is a luggage they would use to get up and travel. And it's very emotional for me to see this wall. And, you know, I'm often asked, what's so special about this wall, and is this your favorite part? And it is, even though we have a Lucille guitar and some of Mr. King's, you know, that he actually played. That's great, but it's this wall, because if it wasn't for this wall, there would be no Mr. King.
So this is a wall of chests. So some of these are authentic, some of these are props, but in each one of these bags, what do we got?
I mean, their whole entire life. I mean, and the memories, and you hear people tell the stories about how their grandmother would pass on these bags and would tell the story about, we brought everything we owned in this right here. It's a very touching story when you hear the oral history that so many people have to tell.
It occurs to me now that in many ways, these people who represent the migration wall and this cultural movement in America didn't even know necessarily that they'd pack the blues along with everything else.
Absolutely. And I love telling, you hit it right on the head. There's nothing like when you hear people talk about it's the St. Louis blues. Well, no, it's really the Delta blues that's got a St. Louis spin on it. It's not the Chicago blues. It's the Delta blues that Chicago's very. And they, like you said, they packed up the blues, moved it from the South, and took it all over the world.
I can remember growing up, we heard the blues, but it was in my mother's cafe. Because during that time, we really didn't have radio stations. So we just had to hear the blues where we were able to.
So one guitar, one singer.
Exactly. And they had what was called a rockola. Are you familiar at all? Well, anyway, there was a person that would come out and service the jukebox, is what they called it. And they would put music on there, and that's how we were able to really listen to the blues. And
So before there were DJs, there were rockolas.
Exactly. And that's how we really heard the blues. And it was just beautiful.
In the end, I decided I might be too bashful to try and sit in with the band. And so UV Hayes, real recording artist, said, "Hey, come on, you old hound dog.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Keep snooping round my door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Keep snooping round my door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more."
Now that was fun. You could feel how the blues and change go together, even on a day when it was easy to think about divided America. Opening day of the baseball season. Arch rivals Chicago Cubs right here next door in St. Louis playing the Cardinals. Blue versus red. The Cardinals won, this time. But everyone seemed to have a happy face. And me. I still felt like a hound dog. A young one, anyway.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Keep snooping around my door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more.
Woo! Nice.
All right.
That's good. Go to thetakeaway.org. You can hear more of me performing live with UV Hayes. And who knew? It's the news that brings out the blues in some of you out there.
First they said he said it. Then he said he didn't. I got no other way to say it, but I feel it from my head to my shoes. I'm up to here with all of these fake news blues. Oh, yeah.
Priceless. We'll have more from St. Louis tomorrow. Join us. Thanks always for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.